A Gardener in Paravon by Brian Craig. This tale, said the storyteller, was told to me by a man of Paravon in far Britonia. He said he had no wish to add to the evil reputation which the city of his birth already had, but that he did not care to bear alone the burden of speculation as to whether his late friend, Armand Carrière, was as utterly and completely mad as everyone chose to believe. You have heard of Paravon, and know of it what everyone knows. You know that it lies beside the great river Grismarie, in the foothills of the Grey Mountains. You know that it is a prosperous city, whose wealthy folk are numerous and much devoted to the arts, as all men are when they need not work for their living and must find some idler way to spend their time. You also know that the beautiful face which it presents in the daylight wears an ugly mask when darkness descends, and that strange and evil things are said to stalk the streets. The man who told this tale, whose name was Philippe Lebel, recommended that those who might have occasion to listen to it should also bear in mind certain other features of the town, which do not figure so large in its reputation, but which have some relevance to his story. Firstly, he asked that hearers of the tale should remember that the crags and crannies of the chalky cliffs which rise around the city provide nesting sites for very many birds, including some which are seen nowhere else in the Old World. Eagles can often be seen about the taller peaks, and it is said that both firebirds and phoenixes have nested there. It is also said that some of the creatures which fly by night about those rookeries are neither birds nor bats, but other things with wings. Secondly, he asked that hearers of the tale should remember that among the arts of which the leisured classes of Paravon are fond, the construction of beautiful and exotic gardens has a special place, and that it is by no means extraordinary for men to devote their lives to the cultivation of rare and special flowers. Thirdly, he asked that hearers of the tale should remember that although the people of the town are apparently orthodox in their religion, following the familiar gods, other kinds of worship are conducted in secret. There are druids in the neighbouring hills, whose mysterious ceremonies are attended by some of the humble folk of Paravon. And there are other gods, perhaps older still, whose veneration is forbidden throughout the Old World, whose true nature none know and few care to contemplate, but whose influence on the affairs of men is sometimes felt in incidents of a specially horrible nature, which may befall the incautious and the unlucky alike. Philippe Lebel had known Armand Carrière since boyhood, and yet had never really known him. Although their fathers were both respectable corn chandlers, like enough in their habits and beliefs to pass for brothers, Philippe and Armand were very different. Where the former strove always to follow convention and to fit in with the society of his peers, the latter set himself apart, finding anything ordinary dull. He came to fancy himself an artist of sorts, though he was equally unskilled as painter, poet, and gardener, and Philippe often thought that his friend's art was simply an ability to see the world from a strange angle, from which it seemed more magical and more malign. He was certainly attracted by all matters unusual and arcane. With the aid of this tilted perception, Armand might have become a spellcaster's apprentice, but his parents would not hear of such a thing, and he excused himself from going against their wishes and hence excising himself from his father's will, by declaring that the wizards of Paravon were in any case a poor and shabby lot, far less powerful than they claimed. Those of you who have travelled will know that this is a common opinion. Familiar spellcasters, if measured by their accomplishments, always seem less able than they claim to be, and less fascinating than more distant wizards, whose abilities can only be measured by rumour and reputation. Young Carriere's affections offended his family, but he saved himself from total disgrace by working hard to master the arts of reading and writing, which his illiterate father commended on the grounds that they might prove very useful to a man in trade. Armand, alas, had no intention of employing these arts in such a vulgar manner. His aim was to entertain himself with books of a questionable character, and seek therein the secrets of arcane knowledge. The Carriere house was tall, and set upon the ridge of a small hill. Armand's room was considered a poor one, set just beneath the eaves of the side of the house, which never caught the sun. He liked it, though, because his was the only window which faced that way, looking upon the wilder part of the hill, which was thick with thorn bushes. The only other building which overlooked that part of the ridge was a tower house, situated at its further edge, nested among dark trees alongside a high-hedged garden. Ever since boyhood, Armand had believed that there was a mystery about that lonely house and its garden, whose hedges were so unnaturally high as to exclude the sun's direct rays, save for a brief period around the hour of noon. While Armand studied his books and practiced his script, he would often sit by the window of his room, looking up occasionally to stare at the hedge. He knew that the plants which grew in that garden must be curious, partly because it was lighted for such a short time each day, and presumably contained only those flowers which could adapt to such a strange regime, but partially because the hedge was so clearly designed to keep prying eyes at bay. Once or twice, when he had been a child, he and Philippe had run the gauntlet of the thorn bushes to reach the bounds of the garden, for there was no path between the two houses. But they had never been able to see what was within. What Armand could see, however, was a certain strange traffic between the garden and the cliffs, where the birds of Paravon made their nests. Most of the gardeners of Paravon considered the birds their enemies, for they would come to peck the new-laid seeds, to spoil the pretty flowers with their droppings, and to devour the fruits which grew upon the bushes. The gardener of the tower house seemed to be an exception, for there was never any indication of birds being shooed away, though they seemed to come in considerable numbers, especially in the hours when the garden was shadowed from the sun. At dusk, when the birds of Paravon were wont to wheel about the roofs, calling to one another stridently as they assembled in flocks before returning to their roosts, the birds which visited this particular garden would rise more sedately, one at a time, and drift away into the gathering gloom. The more Armand watched, the more he became convinced that far more birds flew down to the garden than ever flew up again. Armand called the attention of Philippe le Bel to this phenomenon on more than one occasion, but Philippe believed that his friend was trying to make a mystery out of nothing, and paid no attention. This disinterest served only to make Armand more determined to find a mystery, and he began to seek through the pages in his books for records of carnivorous plants which could trap birds. He found various travellers' tales containing believable accounts of plants which trapped insects, and rather unbelievable accounts of plants which devoured men, but no trace of any rumour about plants which fed on birds. Investigation of the hillside beyond the townhouse revealed that there was no proper road to its gate, but only a path. Armand began to linger at the bottom of that path, waiting to catch a glimpse of the owner of the house, whose name, his father had gruffly told him, was Gaspard Grulier. When Armand had asked further questions, his father had simply disclaimed any further knowledge, and had stated that honest men did not pry into their neighbours' affairs. Armand soon ascertained that Grulier emerged from his solitary lair only 2 or 3 times a week, carrying 2 large bags, which he took to the marketplace and filled up with food. He began to study the man from a distance, and twice followed him into town to watch him go about his humdrum business. Grulier was tall and bald, with eyes which were very dark, yet seemed unnaturally keen and bright. But if he noticed that he was under observation by Armand, he gave no sign of it. Armand asked several of the tradesmen who dealt with Grulier what they knew of him, but none of them could tell what manner of man he was, or how he earned his coin, or to what gods he addressed his prayers. None of the tradesmen had a word to say against their customer, but on one occasion Armand saw a gypsy woman make a sign as he passed, which was supposed to ward off the evil eye. This might have meant nothing at all, for gypsy women are ever so anxious to ward off spells that they frequently make such signs without reason or provocation. But Armand was nevertheless encouraged to believe that she might have a reason. He knew that gypsies were usually followers of the old faith, and wondered whether this Gaspard Grulier might be known to the Druids as a bad man, and perhaps a cleverer one than any of those who went about the city, boasting of their prowess as spellcasters. On 2 or 3 occasions, when he knew that Grulier was not at home, Armand approached the lonely house and peered through its windows. He tried to peer through the hedge, too, as he had done when he was a boy, but it was very thick as well as very tall, and he could see no more now than he ever had. He could hear something from the other side, though, and what he heard was a low rustling sound, which might have been the sound of birds fluttering their wings as they moved among the branches of bushes, or even the murmur of their voices as they clucked and chattered to one another. Those sounds fed his curiosity so temptingly that he hungered to find out more, and this hunger grew in him by degrees until he became determined that he would one day find a way to look into that garden, to see what went on there in the shady hours of the morning and the afternoon. It was unfortunately typical of his frame of mind that he never once considered taking a straightforward course, seeking to make the acquaintance of Gaspard Grulier, so that he might quite legitimately ask what plants the garden contained. Armand knew that he must get higher up if he was to see over the hedge of the enigmatic garden, and there was only one way to do this that was immediately obvious to him. There was no other room above his, but the house had a steeply sloped roof of red tile and a chimney stack which could offer him an extra 12 or 13 feet of elevation, if only he could scale it. Because this seemed a hazardous project, he called upon the help of his friend Philippe, asking him to secure a rope within his room and pay it out yard by yard while he climbed, so that if he fell, the rope would save him from serious injury. Philippe agreed, reluctantly, and waited impatiently when Armand had clambered out, wondering what possible account he could give to the Carrière family should the escapade go wrong. But he need not have worried, because Armand soon came back through the window unharmed, in a state of some excitement. "What did you see?" asked Philippe, caught up for once in the tangled threads of the mystery. "I could not see very much," replied Armand, "but more than I have seen before. There is a trellis work erection, perhaps a kind of summer house, though I could only see the top of it, which is longer than it is broad, having the house at one end and an open space at the other. The trellis work looks like the sort which is sometimes placed against the wall of a building to assist climbing roses and honeysuckle, but I could not tell whether there was a wall within. The roof of the trellis bears flowers of several different hues, huge flowers, with heads like trumpets. There are birds there, wandering about. And did you see these flowers seizing and devouring the unfortunate birds? Asked Philippe. No, I did not, admitted Armand. But I have not seen the like of those flowers before, and I feel sure that there is something strange about them. Oh, Armand, said his friend, are you not satisfied? Must you still insist that although what you have seen is by your own account most ordinary, what remains hidden from you must be something unparalleled in its strangeness? The birds are ordinary, repeated Armand insistently, but their situation is not. I have never seen the flowers before, nor have I seen such a structure to mount them. What pleasure could it give a gardener to place his best blooms on the roof of a structure where he could not see them? Ah, said Philippe, but he can see them, can he not, from the upper windows of his own house? And you have said yourself that the garden gets too little sun. Is it not probable that the entire purpose of this structure is to lift the flowers up so that they receive more? If this speech was intended to set Armand's mind at rest, it failed, for Armand was no longer listening. Instead, he was standing by his window, looking out in the direction of Gaspard Grillier's house. Philippe went to stand by him and to see what he was looking at, and saw that the shutters of one window which faced this way, which had been closed only a few minutes before, had now been thrown back. There was a man standing at the window, just as Armand was standing at his, and he was staring at the Carrière house. Philippe drew back reflexively, but could not resist peeping around the angle of the window to see what would happen. After standing there for little more than a minute, Grillier went away, leaving the shutters undone.
He must have seen you on the roof, said Philippe.
I suppose he must, replied Armand. But what of it? A man may climb upon the roof of his own house, if he wants to. Despite the bravado of his words, however, Armand's face was pale and frightened. It was as though all his excitement had been turned by that cool stare into anxiety. And yet, muttered Armand, hardly loud enough for his friend to hear the words, there is something secret about that garden, and I would dearly love to know what it is. I feel an attraction to it, as though it had placed a spell on me. It is only a garden, said Philippe soothingly, and by no means the only one in Paravon to contain special blooms, whose owners strive to hide them from potential thieves. That night, Armand closed the shutters of his window tightly, as he always did, as all men do in Paravon, if they have any sense. But in his sleep, he had a very curious dream, in which there was a tapping at those shutters, and a fluttering sound of wings in hectic motion, and a sharp scraping sound as though a claw was dragged momentarily across the outer face of each shutter. Had he been really awake, Armand would have clapped his hands to his ears and prayed for the morning to come, for he knew well enough that monsters were reputed to haunt the night in that city. But he was not awake, and threw back the shutters so that he looked out boldly into the starlit night, as he had never dared to do before. He was startled by the eerie brightness of the light which the stars gave, and as he peered out into that imperfect gloom, he saw black shadows moving within it, sinister night flyers, larger by far than those birds which filled the sky by day. Though he could not follow these shadows as they wheeled and soared in the starry sky, he became convinced that it was around the roof of the tower house that they gathered. and when he looked at the tower house, he saw that the window from which Gaspard Grulier had looked out in the daytime was unshuttered, with a red light burning within it, and that someone stood there, looking out, just as Armand was. Perhaps Grulier, perhaps another. And there was a strange scent in the air, like exotic perfume, which made him intoxicated as he breathed it in, and made him almost ready to believe that he could fly. The next day, when he tried to recall this dream, he could remember it up to that point, but not beyond. He did not know what had happened next, if anything further had happened at all. He told what he could remember to Philippe le Bel, and found himself quite carried away when he told it, so that he argued very fiercely that the night flyers he had seen were too huge to be ordinary birds. They might, as he assured Philippe with rapt insistence, have been anything. "Well," said Philippe, "what of it? In our dreams we may see whatever we will. We meet more demons there than we ever could in everyday life." Armand did not take offence at this remark, but simply took his friend to the window, where the shutters had been thrown back to let in the daylight. He pulled one of them back until it was closed, and invited Philippe to crane his neck and inspect its outer surface. Then he opened that one and pulled the other back, in order to allow a similar inspection. Philippe saw that there were three long scratches in the wood, extending across both shutters, and when he measured their span with his hand, he shuddered to think what manner of claw it might have been which had made them. "But after all," said Philippe, "even if the scratching sound was real, the rest was only a dream, for you did not actually rise from your bed and open the shutters, did you?" "Did I not?" said Armand quizzically. But then, after a moment's hesitation, he threw the shutters wide again. "You are right," he said. "I did not, and I surely never will." Armand attempted to put Gaspard Grulier out of his thoughts for the remainder of that day, and returned with a new will to the study of a book he had found, which had much to say about the tenets of the old faith. He tried not to dwell on the matter of the garden, but could not help pausing whenever he found a reference to flowers, lest he find some clue regarding the nature of the unknown blooms which he had seen upon the trellis in the hidden garden. But there were far too many flowers mentioned in connection with the worship of the old faith, with far too little in the way of description to allow them to be easily identified. The next night, and next, he slept very fitfully. Once or twice he was convinced that he heard the nearby flutter of wings, but nothing tapped at his shutters and nothing scratched the wood. He did not dream. Indeed, it seemed that whenever he was about to escape from anxious wakefulness into the comfort of a dream, he was snatched back from its brink, so that he might continue to toss and turn upon his pallet. By day, he tried to tell himself that he had done everything he could to fathom the mystery, and must be content to let it alone. Indeed, he came close to convincing himself that he had had enough of Grulier's garden, and did not care about it any more. But this was a mere sham, which could not stand the test of temptation. 3 days after his expedition onto the roof, Armand and Philippe were walking in the street, intent on their conversation, when suddenly they found their way blocked. When they looked up to see who had accosted them, they were most surprised to discover that it was Grulier.
"You are Carrier's son, are you not?" he said, addressing Armand after directing a brief but polite smile at Philippe. "You are my nearest neighbour, I believe. You are interested in my garden."
All the colour had drained from Armand's cheeks, and he was too surprised to reply.
"I would like to show it to you, now that the proper season has come," Grulier continued amiably.
The birds love to visit it, as you must have observed." Armand still did not seem disposed to reply, so Philippe intervened, saying rather uncertainly, "You are kind, sir. Armand and I would be pleased to see your flowers." Grolier responded with a little bow, "The time is not exactly right just yet," he said. "I think you will see the blooms at their very best in 3 days' time. I would like you to see them at their very best."
"Shall we come at noon?" asked Philippe.
"That would be perfect," replied the other, bowing again and walking on.
"Well," said Philippe proudly to his silent friend, "here is something to set your mind at rest for once and for all. We will see his garden, and the mystery will be extinguished. But I do think you might have spoken to him yourself. He seems a pleasant enough fellow, after all."
Armand seemed to be about to disagree, but in the end he simply nodded and said,
"Perhaps it is all for the best. We will go together and see what there is to be seen."
At the appointed hour, Philippe and Armand made their way up the path to Gaspard Grulier's door. Armand had told his father about the invitation, and had asked again what he knew about his neighbour, but the elder Carrière had simply shrugged his shoulders and said that tradesmen had no right to pry into the affairs of others unless their credit was suspect. And that, as far as he knew, Gaspard Grulier had no significant debts. When Armand knocked, he was promptly answered, and Grulier took them through his house to the side door, which was the entrance to the garden. The rooms through which they passed were well furnished. The quality of the rugs and wall hangings suggested that Grulier was not a poor man, but there was no clue to his occupation. They did not linger in the house, passing rapidly into the garden. As they came through the garden door, such a sight met their eyes that Philippe drew his breath very sharply, and Armand released a gasp of surprise. As they had already discovered, the centrepiece of the garden was a rectangular trellis-work erection, which formed a kind of tunnel, arching over a path which led from the doorway of the house to the open space at the garden's further end. This tunnel now extended before them, so that they saw it from the inside. It had many open spaces like small windows in the top and the sides, and because the sun was high in the sky, the ones set in the roof were admitting distinct shafts of sunlight, slanted from the south, which made a pattern on the paving stones beneath the bower, as if to mark out a series of stepping stones. There were no green leaves or coloured flowers inside the tunnel. Its walls were matted with dangling tendrils, which were white or pale pink in colour. The great majority of these tendrils lay limp and still, though some trembled, even though they were not busy. The minority, however, had a most curious occupation, for they were wrapped tightly around the still corpses of birds, writhing ceaselessly as they played with their prey, and passed their shriveling bodies slowly along the wall. While they watched, Philippe and Armand saw a tiny bird come from without to perch upon the rim of one of the windows, peering into the tunnel with evident curiosity, as though wondering whether it had somehow stumbled upon a paradise of edible worms. But then it began fluttering its wings in panic, trying to launch itself back into the air, as it became aware that its tiny feet had been caught and held. Within 30 seconds the tendrils had pulled their victim inside, away from the window, and were dragging it across the inner face of the tunnel. Its struggles were short-lived, though Philippe could not tell precisely how it had been killed. Grulier said nothing at first, but
but simply watched his guests, smiling at their confusion. Eventually he said, "I know that you have not seen their like before, my friends. There is nothing like this in any other garden in Paravon, but this is not a pretty sight, and I am sure that you would prefer to look at the lovely flowers." He led the two youths to the outside of the bower, where they could see the woody trunks of the climbing plants embedded in the soil, and the pale green leaves which surrounded the huge blossoms. The nearest flowers grew just above head height, and there was little foliage close to the ground because that part of the bower never caught the sun at all. The growth was lush, but the pattern of the trellis work could clearly be seen from without, whereas it had been masked within by the sheer profusion of the clinging tendrils. There were many birds fluttering about the garden. They were all, as Armand had lately observed from the roof of his house, perfectly ordinary. They wandered aimlessly about, as though they too were visitors invited for a leisurely inspection, come to enjoy the beauty of the blooms. They went unmolested as they perched on the outer stems and branches, only when they alighted by the windows, within reach of the pale tentacles, were they seized and pulled inside, without so much as a cry of alarm. The flowers, as Armand had reported, were of many different colours, but all of one shape. Each flower was the size of a man's head, shaped like a bell, with a bright waxen style which rather resembled, Philippe could not help but notice, a male sex organ. But there were no stamens gathered around the styles, unless they were confined to the most secret recesses of the bells. "These flowers are very rare," Gaspard Grulliere assured them. "You will not find their like anywhere in Bretonnia, save perhaps for the deepest parts of the wild forests. Nowhere in the world, I think, are so many gathered in any one place, for these plants are usually solitary. The bower is my own design, and I am proud of it. I knew that unusual steps would have to be taken if these beautiful things were to be persuaded to grow in such profusion as this. Perhaps Paravon is the only place in the world where it could be done. Where else could one find so very many silly birds?" Neither of his guests knew how to reply. But this time it was Armand, and not Philippe, who found his tongue. "They are very beautiful," he admitted. He reached up to touch one, and ran his finger around the rim of the bell. Then he touched the tip of the style, which Philippe would have been embarrassed to do, given its shape, but took his hand away suddenly, with a slight start of surprise. He looked at the tip of his finger, where there was a tiny droplet of liquid, red as blood. "Do not worry," said Gaspard Grulliere. "When the flowers are at their best, they produce wonderful nectar." He reached upward to another blossom, so that his sleeve fell away from his unusually thin arm, and Philippe was surprised to see that his hand was slightly deformed, and that the fingers were like the claws of a bird. Grulliere did as Armand had done, and brought his finger away from the flower head with a drop of red liquid on its horny tip. He put the finger to his mouth, licking away the drop with the tip of his tongue. "It is sweet," he said. "Please try it. It will do you no harm." Armand hesitated, but then put out his tongue and touched the liquid to it. "Oh, yes," he said with evident surprise. "Very sweet indeed." They both looked at Philippe, inviting him to try the experiment for himself. But he looked away and pretended not to notice. While this occurred, they had been walking along beside the flowered wall, And now they came to the further end of the bower, to the open space which separated the trellis from the hedge. Here there grew in a ragged circle 5 remarkable things, which looked like giant toadstools, each one with a thick, chitinous pedestal and a wide cap coloured black and silver. This colour was so odd that Philippe thought at first they might be carved from stone, but when he came closer, he saw that they had the proper texture of fungal flesh. He did not want to touch one merely to make sure, but Armand was not so shy, and placed his hand upon the nearest one.
"It's warm," he said in surprise.
"An ugly thing," said Grillier apologetically, "but not everything rare and precious is beautiful. And these are no more common than my lovely blossoms. They are not so attractive to birds, but they have their own place in the scheme of nature, as all things have."
This little speech reminded Philippe of Armand's earlier conviction that Grillier was known to the followers of the old faith, and he wondered if the man might be a druid spellcaster who cultivated these strange things because of some virtue which they had. But it was not the sort of matter which could be raised in polite conversation, and so he held his tongue. As Grillier led them back to the house, he said, "I am sure that you will think my garden odd. And so it is. Perhaps you will think it is cruel to raise flowers which feed on birds. But they are very beautiful flowers, are they not? And Paravon has no shortage of birds, as you must certainly agree. There is room in the great wide world for many different gardens, and many different kinds of beauty." Afterwards he watched them as they walked down the path towards the town. But he had gone inside by the time they turned the corner to walk around the foot of the ridge, returning to the house where Armand lived. Philippe was eager to discuss what they had seen in Gaspard Grillier's garden, but Armand was disinclined to accommodate him. It had surprised Philippe to learn that Armand's wild surmise about the fate of the birds which visited the garden was actually correct, and it seemed to him an item of gossip worth spreading, for Grillier had not asked them to keep silent about what they had seen. Armand, on the other hand, seemed only to desire solitude and the company of his books, so Philippe soon left him alone. When night fell, Armand closed and locked the shutters of his window as usual, and went to his bed in a state of some exhaustion, having slept so badly of late. This time, however, sleep came very quickly to claim him, and he did not toss and turn at all. He was later to tell Philippe that he believed he had slept dreamlessly for a long while before he was visited by a very dreadful nightmare. The nightmare began, as had his peculiar dream of some days earlier, with the sound of something attempting to gain admission at his window, first by rapping as though to demand that he open the shutters, and then by tearing at the edge of the wood with clawed fingers. In the end, Armand explained, his dream self had risen from the bed and gone to the window, unlocking the shutters and throwing them open. There, hanging upside down from the eaves like a great bat, was a monstrous creature with brightly coloured feathered wings and a man-like face with thick, rubbery lips. Its body resembled a plucked bird, the skin all puckered and dappled, and its limbs, of which there were 4 in addition to the wings, were like the limbs of eagles, scaly and taloned. This creature snatched at Armand's dream self and lifted him as though he weighed hardly anything at all, but this action was not hostile and almost seemed protective, for as the demon launched itself into flight, It hugged Armand to its bosom, as a mother might clutch a child. Fearful of falling, Armand wrapped his arms around the waist of the peculiar creature, as though accepting and returning its embrace. He reported that as he flew, he could feel the beating of the great muscles in the demon's breast, where his face was pressed against the wrinkled skin. There were, he said, no teats upon that breast, and which an infant could suck. The flight was but a short one, for it took him only to the further end of the ridge, where Gaspard Grillier's house stood, with the facing window wide open and brightly lit, as though the tower were a lighthouse for the insidious things which haunted Paravon at night. Armand was delivered by his carrier into the garden beside the house, and found himself in the space between the end of the bower and the five great toadstools, which did not form a circle, as Armand now perceived them, but a pentacle. Inside the pentacle stood a creature, like the one which had brought him, but bigger by far, standing almost as tall as the strange high hedge. Its vast wings were feathered like the legendary firebird, glowing from within, all glorious in red and gold. Its capacious arms were stretched aloft, with the claws widespread as though to catch the silver light of the bountiful stars. Its slender legs had flattened feet like those of a fowl, so that it could stand upon the ground instead of searching for a perch, as its smaller companions must. The expression on its face as it looked at Armand was paradoxical, for the face, so Armand said, was uglier than he could ever have imagined, with horrid bloodshot eyes and a nose like a huge serrated beak, mounted above a mouth crowded with sharpened teeth. "And yet," said Armand, "the gaze of those foul eyes was not predatory, but fond, and the black tongue which crawled in serpentine fashion between the cluttered teeth was not licking the outer lips, as though in anticipation of a meal, but teasing him with its little motions, as a mother might tease her child with friendly grimaces." When his dream self had borne this inspection for a few long minutes, Armand felt himself taken up again and lifted to the roof of the bower, where the brightest and the best flowers grew, and he was tenderly placed among them in the middle of a crowd of perching demons. He already knew what to do, and bowed his head immediately to a succulent bloom, taking the central style into his mouth, as all the others were doing, sucking greedily at the milk which was within, carefully prepared by the wondrous flowers from the tender flesh of captured birds. The taste, so Armand said, was sweeter than he ever could have imagined, though his father's table, at which he had feasted throughout his life, had been as well supplied with sugary delicacies as that of any tradesman in the city of Paravon. When Armand related this dream to Philippe, he told him that there had been more, and that his wild adventure must have continued for several hours, but that the rest of it evaded his waking memory and could not be recalled. Philippe was more impressed by this dream than he had been by the first which Armand had related. He was almost ready to believe that there was something truly awful about the garden which they had seen, and that Gaspard Grillier might actually have signed some dire pact with the demons of Paravon. And yet, he told himself as he listened to Armand's feverish recital, a dream is only a dream, and the shutters at the window had never in fact been opened, nor were there any additional scratches to be seen upon their outer face. With these doubts in mind, Philippe told Armand that his nightmare, however frightening it may have been, could not be taken seriously as a revelation. Perhaps, he suggested, the dream had been a kind of release, by which all the anxiety Armand had been storing up had at last been discharged. Armand dismissed this explanation out of hand.
There is more, he said excitedly. For when I woke this morning and went to my book, I discovered at last the passage for which I have been searching, the passage which helps to explain what manner of thing these monstrous flowers are, and what dreadful harm they can do.
So saying, Armand placed the open book before his friend. But Philippe could not read, and Armand was forced to say aloud what was written there.
"The followers of the old faith," he quoted, "believe that every living element of the natural world is properly destined for the nourishment of others. As the flower feeds the bee, which will make honey for the bear, so the leaf feeds the worm, which will later take flight as a brightly coloured thing, which will feed the bird, which feeds the hawk, which will fall in time to earth, as the bear falls also, to feed the tiny things which crowd the fertile soil, where the roots draw nourishment to feed the flower and the leaf. So it is that everything which lives is born from the soil and the sea and the air, and must return in time to soil, sea, and air, so that all may be renewed, forever and ever, without pause or end. But the followers of the old faith say also that there is an evil in the world, which seeks to pervert the weave of destiny. There is an evil which alters the flower, or the leaf, to become the nourishment of demons, so to spread the seed of chaos within the world. Those who believe this have the following warning to give to the unwary. Beware the treacherous beauty of that which is food for demons, for though it harbours the milk of ecstasy, it promises destruction.
When he heard this, Philippe le Bel felt a chill in his heart, and for just one moment he saw the world as Armand Carrière saw it, as a peculiar and magical place, full of threats and confusions, in which no man could live in comfort and safety. It was not the kind of world in which he desired to spend the remainder of his days.
"Can you not see," said Armand, "that Grulier keeps his garden for the nourishment of demons, who fly there by night? I cannot tell whether he is their servant, or their master, or what he may have to do with the other horrid things which happen in Paravon by night. But this I know, that man's soul is not his own, and his garden is a thing so vile as to terrify the mind of any honest man."
But Philippe would have none of this. "Armand," he said, truly believing that he was reaching out a helping hand to save his friend from unworthy fears, "this is nonsense. The old faith is for gypsies and the ragged men of the forests. We are of the town, and have better gods to guide us. The excellent gardeners of Paravon have shown us that the flowers of the wild are there to be tamed, arranged and regimented to our pleasure. Gaspard Grulier is but a gardener, after all. He does not seek to make a secret of his garden, but willingly took us into it to show off his pride in his achievement. Lay down that book, I beg you, and take up another which will teach you the ways of the merchant in the market and the arts of civilized men." Philippe said that his friend looked long and hard at him then, but said nothing, and finally laid the book aside. They both went to the window to stare across the ridge at the tower house, and the tall, dark hedge which surrounded its garden.
"Did we really play along that ridge when we were children?" asked Philippe, with a small laugh.
The thorn bushes must have been sparser then, for I'm sure that we could not find a way among them now.
It was a long time ago,
Armand replied.
And we were children then. Very different from what we have become.
Early the next day, Armand's mother came to his room to search for him, because he had not come to breakfast. She found the room empty, with the bed in disarray and the shutters wide open. She went to the window and looked out, and immediately saw her son's body, some little distance from the wall, deep in the bosom of a thorn bush. It was not easy to reach the body, and the elder Carrière had to call upon the assistance of his neighbours to hack a way through to it. Philippe was one of those who helped with this dire work, and thus was able to see the corpse of his friend before it was taken, with great difficulty, from the bush. It was plain that Armand had fallen into the bush from a height, and the only sensible hypothesis which could be offered in explanation was that he had undone the shutters of his window during the hours of darkness, climbed up onto the sill, and launched himself from it in a prodigious leap, which had delivered him inevitably to his fate. The thorns had punctured him in very many places, hard driven by the force of his fall. And when they had finally pulled him free of the bush, they saw that there was hardly an inch of his flesh unmolested. It was as though he had been ripped and rent by many wicked claws. When the company returned to the Carrière house, Philippe told them all about the dreams which Armand had suffered, and about the visit to Gaspard Grillier's strange garden. Because it was the first time he had told the story, it was far more confused in the telling than the version which you have just heard, but it would probably have made no difference if every detail had been in its proper place. For these were townsmen and tradespeople, and though they bolted their doors most carefully at night, they were inclined to believe that whatever the dark might hide was no concern of theirs. Nightmares, they agreed, were a sign of madness and folly, and if any more proof were needed that poor Armand had been utterly deranged, one only had to look at the peculiar books which he had chosen to read. As for Gaspard Grillier, the elder Carrière and all his friends were unanimous in declaring him a good neighbour. If the plants in his garden captured and devoured birds, that was certainly peculiar. But Paravon had no shortage of birds, and the great majority were a nuisance to other gardeners. So Grillier's activities must be counted to the public good. And if any further proof were needed that the gardener was worthy to live amongst honest tradespeople, there was the universally acknowledged fact that he was a man with no significant debts.
I have a distinct Mandela effect style experience, where I am convinced that I read somewhere that the specific brief that the writers of the Warhammer fantasy roleplay game were given was that they should create a fantasy version of the Call of Cthulhu RPG, because that game was so popular in the mid-80s. I've never been able to rediscover where I read this, and I'm fairly certain that I've asked Warhammer writers about this and been told that it wasn't the case. So maybe it's me having the strange, unprovable dreams. In any case, I think it's undeniable that the Wefrup RPG and Enemy Within campaigns, with its focus on cults, impending global disaster, and unrelating harshness of the cosmos owe something to the Call of Cthulhu game and its scenarios. Both have PCs spending quite a lot of time trying to stop rituals from happening in one form or another, at the very least. Consequently, it's unsurprising that a story like A Gardener in Paravon that comes out of the Warhammer world might therefore find fertile ground in emulating the weird fiction of Lovecraft and his contemporaries. The basic format of having two young men as your protagonists, one more practically minded, the other more attuned to the strange, is certainly a feature of Lovecraft. From early tales like The Statement of Randolph Carter and Herbert West Reanimator, through to Pickman's Model. It also emulates the Lovecraftian trope of informing you at the opening that the protagonist will end in a state of perceived madness. Craig does, however, shy away from giving us a first-person narrator that is common in these stories, although that might be because Games Workshop had banned first-person voices at some point in the development process of the fiction. Whilst Craig's The Phantom of Remy gives us quite a weak set of references to Poe, this story does capture the disquieting anticipation of weird fiction in a pretty effective way. This is probably enhanced by Craig's decision to include the old faith in the story. Usually, stories that reference bits of the Warhammer setting that got quietly dropped over time do not bode well. Elementalists or Dawnstones never particularly inspire us. But Craig is pretty good at taking the Warhammer's So You Want to Be a Druid religion and integrating it into horrific elements. Here, chaos and demons are a corruption of the natural cycle of life and a natural order that is worshipped as a survival of a far earlier time. This sense of an ancient and possibly half-curdled religion existing alongside the bourgeois concerns of the Bretonian nouveau riche gives us a little sense of the work of Arthur Machen, whose work often focuses on the idea of survivals from a world before our own that exists at the fringes of things, but waits to come writhing back. Although it doesn't relate to the authors I mention, I did like the way that the corruption in the story is partly that of the natural food chain thrown into reverse, so that the plants eat the animals rather than the animals the plants. There are lots of nice touches within the story that give us an effective atmosphere, indeed. Whilst one comes away from the story, not much more sure what has taken place than one was at the start, the atmosphere captures something a bit more disturbing than your usual fanatical chaos worship. Having said this, I think Craig probably doesn't get chaos in the way that some of the other authors do. Or at the very least, I think Craig is far more interested in the Faust pastiche version of chaos that we know from Shadows Over Bogerhofen than the inhabitants of the Chaos Wastes. Demons are creatures that have some sort of pact with humans here, although, as it says, it's unclear whether as servant or master, and that is an idea that is a rapidly diminishing one by the time the second Realm of Chaos book is on its way, replaced by a chaos that owes a lot more to the four great chaos gods. Interestingly, this echoes early modern ideas about evil magical practices and witchcraft, and how they changed from those in the medieval period. Medieval people concerned themselves with maleficium, harmful magic, that might well feature treating with evil spirits of some sort, and this seems to be what Gaspard is doing, holding some sort of uneasy truce or alliance with the creatures. By contrast, early modern witchcraft was a crime that was believed to involve a more metaphysical offence, rejecting Christianity and accepting Satan as your patron, much more like the self-blasting act of falling to the worship of the chaos gods. Exactly what Grulier has done seems almost too prosaic, even though it results in murder, for it to feel like the work of the four great gods and their apocalyptic qualities. Indeed, the very horror of the story stems, at least in part, from the fact that this type of thing can be going on and nobody really cares to investigate. It's not the siege of Prague, but rather the continual corruption of Paravon that nobody notices so long as you don't have credit card debt that causes you a problem. Rather like last week's story, we are being given here another take on what chaos in the Warhammer world might have been, and just like the Voyage South, it's an alternate version whose potential stories are interesting to imagine. I suppose the other thing that stood out to me about this story, that I had kind of forgotten, is that it's a story about a weird old man who tries to convince two young guys to come into his garden and lick up the juice that is dripping from the end of his penis flowers, which is then followed by one of them being collected by a weird flying monster with mothering qualities who clasps the young man to its nippleless chest while other monsters all fly around sucking the penis flowers and living their best lives. Recently, people have become much more cagey about the idea of equating the queer and the chaotic, and therefore equaling queerness with the great evil of the world. I observed some Twitter discourse the other day claiming that Slaanesh had never been about sexual deviation from the norm, but had in fact always been about excess in general terms. That is not something that I think stands up to very much exploration of the original art associated with the god, and I think it certainly doesn't work with whatever chaos practices are taking place in this story. I am struck instead that this is a very 80s revulsion towards the homoerotic experience. Philippe is not tempted to taste the flower, but Armand does. And even though almost immediately afterwards he turns against Gruyère and sees Gruyère for the associate of demons that he is, it is almost immediately too late, and the clock is ticking on his inevitable demise. I am not for a moment saying that this is a conscious or crafted AIDS analogy, but something of the whiplash spasm that sees Armand go from an artistically inclined young man who tastes a flower to a doomed soul dreaming of demons would, I argue, reflect the roiling anxiety around desires to be sexually free that were the zeitgeist of that moment. I liked this story in the end. There's something in the alternative version of chaos and the deliberate ambiguity and lack of explanation of what's going on that gives it the cosmically strange feel of a weird tale. We have two more Brian Craig stories coming up. Is this the beginning of the Brian Craig redemption arc for me? Please feel free to comment on the show in the posts on the Oldhammer, Rogue Trader, or Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay First Edition Facebook groups, or to leave a review if you are so inclined. Please tell friends if this is the type of thing that might interest them. You can also follow me on Twitter, where I post at Lewis Kerno about, history, this podcast, RPGs, miniatures, and Turnip 28. Next time, we're on to the second of our Brian Craig stories, The Way of the Witchfinder.